Hello, I'm Shivana Musa, welcoming you to the New Books Network. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Jan Lemnitzer about his new book, Power, Law, and the End of Privateering. The book is the result of extensive archival research, which analyses the British approach to neutral rights in the Crimean War, the tenuous relationship between the US and international law, and in particular how this was addressed by Europeans during the American Civil War, and Bismarck's threat of, quote, violent redemption during the Franco-German War of 1870 to 1871. All of this unveils a crucial understanding of the 19th century history of international law. Our guest, Dr. Jan Lemnitzer, is a lecturer and fellow in history at Oxford University and was previously the director of studies for the Changing Character of War research project. So without further ado, let's interview our guest. Thank you for agreeing to talk to us, Jan, here at the network about your new book.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Shivana. Very honoured to present my new book.
Right. Well, I think we should get into the first question of the day. In terms of how the book first came to be, I think the listeners would really like to know what prompted you to write it. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
It's a long story, and it really goes back to a moot court competition in international law that I was talked into joining. And that was much more intense than I anticipated, and I ended up spending 6 months working extremely hard on matters of maritime international law. And at the time, I was also looking for a topic for a master thesis in history. And I thought I only knew I wanted to do the 19th century, and I already also knew that no other German historian or any historian had ever spent that much effort looking into matters of maritime law. So I thought, given all the trade that was going on and the interactions in the 19th century, there must be an interesting topic there. And in my year in Oxford, I asked for a tuition on 19th century maritime law, and they managed to organize it. And, one tutor just asked me to say, okay, look at every 19th century maritime law treaty and come back in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I came back and I said, well, I've looked at everyone I could find and they're all boring, with one exception, because they're all very much standard bilateral trade treaties. And then there's this one big thing, which has only four articles, none of which I understood. But the preamble said this was about preserving world peace, and it was signed by all great powers of the age. So I presented this to my tutor and said, what is this Declaration of Paris thing? What is this about? And he just came back with a big smile and said, well, that's the one we all don't really understand. Yeah, and then that was sealed for me. Then I knew this is what I wanted to do.
Wow. And how many years was the book in terms of writing it? And was it quite a stressful period, or was it quite interesting? What was the process for you?
Well, the process was very lengthy. I mean, I ended up writing a master thesis about it in Heidelberg University. Mm-hmm. And ended up going to a Bremen State Archive.
Right.
Because they part of the chapter is an unknown campaign where the little state of Bremen tried to measure up to Britain and change international law in their favor, and they got surprisingly far. And I discovered their campaigning archive and all the contemporary propaganda literature. And that suddenly gave me an insight as to what this was about.
Right.
And so I could work from there. And then I took it to the London School of Economics, where I spent 4 years writing a PhD on this Declaration of Paris and just sort of sorting it out once and for all, going to all the major archives, spending a lot of time in the United States, France, Germany, Netherlands, going to places where no one had gone before to look for archival documentation on this. And in many cases, you know, you have to do these compulsory interviews at archives at the beginning, and they say, okay, so what do you hope to find here? And I explained it to them and just got sort of these vacant looks and people thinking, I don't think we own material like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out that actually, because it was so important at the time, it has all been put together in nice files that could be harvested really easy. It's just that nobody had done it before.
Well, it sounds like it was a very exciting process, going somewhere that no one's been before, as you say. In terms of the actual book itself, of course, we've said it's called Power, Law, and the End of Privateering. Now, why do you think the relationship between power and law is so rarely explored?
I think there's two main reasons for that. The first reason is a widespread, rather cynical attitude to international law. And it's both on the right and the left wing of the political spectrum that people subscribe to the idea that might makes right, but they tend to mean two different things by that. Sort of on the political right, especially in the United States, people think if you're powerful, you basically do what you want, and there's nothing much the rest of the world can do about it if they're not as powerful as you are. And that's how the world works. And sort of more on the left wing of the or liberal wing of the political spectrum, it's the idea that power allows you to write the rules. So international law is the tool of the powerful to oppress the less powerful. The problem with that interpretation, or both interpretations, is that sort of the power gives you right argument doesn't really explain why so many states spend so much effort on international law and pay so much people so much money to look after it for them. And the power allows you to write the rules argument doesn't really explain why powerful states picked a system that gives small states so much say, both in the creation and the enforcement of norms. So the argument I came up with is the idea of international law as house rules of the international community, as rules that govern shared spaces where we constantly interact. And if we lived in sort of a Hobbesian world where every standoff is decided by power, nothing would get done. I mean, the reason why we don't live in a Hobbesian world is that it would be a real pain. Mm-hmm. And it's very inefficient if you want to do business across borders. And the example I've used in the book is like a condominium where everyone owns their own apartment and is sort of sovereign in their own space. But everyone has a shared interest in house rules because you have shared spaces in the building. And there's this potential of constantly annoying each other and creating disputes. And so people will agree to house rules and will enforce them. Mm-hmm. So, for example, that you can't have open fires in shared spaces.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The second big reason why it's not done very often is that once you get into it, you need to master the detail. And that can get very difficult, and few people have that level of training, especially because the sources are often created in part of a contemporary propaganda battle as to what is international law on a particular point. So the sources constantly try to mislead you, and you have to see through the struggles over competing principles and see whether someone is summarizing the law or trying to fool you. And because these questions about how the world works, how the international system is organized, they tend to be asked by people in the international relations. And these scholars often lack the skills on the history side and on the legal side to actually come up with persuasive research that looks at it thoroughly. And sort of having the training on both the history and the legal side, I just took the liberty of nicking my research questions from the IR literature.
Right. Okay. I mean, this book certainly fills that hole, as you would say, in terms of digging into this relationship between power and law. And in particular, I want to point to something that you mention in your introduction where you say that your book actually details how the first global norms on the laws of war were created and enforced. Now, I'm going to ask you a bit of a big question here, and it sort of goes to the crux of what you write in your quite frankly groundbreaking book, on how your book does this, and how do you actually integrate then these ideas of power and law into it?
Well, big question.
Yes.
So I'll split it straight away into norm creation and norm enforcement, and start with norm creation and look at the genesis of the Declaration of Paris. I mean, what this thing actually is, and then talk about what this means on a grander scale as for how we create international law. It all started with a temporary solution for the Crimean War in 1854. Because this was the first time that England and France were fighting a joint war. So they had joint naval squadrons confronting the Russians. The problem with that was that for centuries, Britain and France had held to competing interpretations of maritime law. So they had very different rules as to what happens if... A vessel of war meets, say, a Dutch neutral vessel that has Russian cargo on board. So the French and the British would deal with that problem in an entirely different way. And they realized that this would not be very popular with the wider trading world at large and create lots of disputes. So they decided to combine their approaches for the duration of the war and take the most liberal aspects of both principles. So I don't want to go into the detail, but it would basically mean that in this case, the Dutch trader would be free to carry his Russian goods unless there were sort of arms and ammunition. And so a liberal principle benefiting neutral trade that Britain had for centuries tried to prevent was suddenly implemented by Britain. Simply because they could not have enforced this in a joint war with France. Now, at this moment, the United States sees an opportunity to get this liberal compromise that is for the duration of the war into the rule book of the Law of Nations. And they want to bind Britain to it now that they've agreed to it in a formal arrangement. And they come up with a really innovative idea, because they start with a treaty with Russia, and they suggest a new idea to the Russians and say, well, what about if we do away with all these cumbersome standard procedures for ratification and just call upon every state in the world to join this treaty and affirm these principles as international law by a simple accession declaration? Yeah. And every state that makes this declaration ipso facto becomes a treaty party with everyone else who has made this declaration in the past or in the future. And that was radical and new. This attempt failed because Britain and France put lots of effort into dissuading others from joining this treaty and saying, well, there's a war going on and, you know, be careful. But the danger that the Americans would try again after the war remained. And so what happens is that the French combine the idea of creating new rules by a treaty that is open to everyone and where everyone can join, with the dignity and the recognized lawmaking powers of a grand European Peace Congress. So when the Crimean War ends... and they've done the peace deal, they stay together for another 2 weeks and come up with other ideas to discuss, such as arbitration. But the most important one is the moment when suddenly the British and the French delegates stand up and say, why don't we have a treaty on maritime law and a ban on privateering? And the ban of privateering is crucial here because that is the sweetener for Britain to accept this new liberal regime that gives neutrals so much more scope for trading in wartime and makes it so much harder for a big naval power to pursue them. And the reason why Britain accepts that is twofold. I mean, some are liberals and they believe in a world where international trade will lead to global prosperity and peace. I mean, these are the heydays of the Manchester School. But there's also some people who think the real value of this is that we will get a ban of privateering. And because we start with this major congress and all the other states will join because they want the liberal neutral rights, that means privateering will become unviable. Now, in the entire literature, scanned as it is on this field, people thought, well, this privateering ban isn't really important. This is a medieval right. This is a relic. It has no real relevance to the 19th century anymore, and that's why they ended without further ado. And what I found out is that it's actually the opposite. Actually, Britain is on the brink of war with the United States in 1856, as they would be again in 1861, and they are very concerned about privateering, and have been for the even in the Crimean War, because their fear is that the U.S. merchant navy, which is by now the second largest in the world, will convert their merchant vessels into privateers and attack British trade across the globe, everywhere. And that means that even the Royal Navy would not be big enough to protect all this commerce, and that means insurance rates would soar and make a lot of the trade that keeps Britain in business and profitable and give the exchequer a great income in duties would simply disappear. And a similar effect happened at the very beginning of the Crimean War, just because there were rumors that Americans might sign up as Russian privateers. Yeah? So in a war with Britain, this effect would be rather dramatic, because a lot of Americans threaten quite openly and talk about 1,000 privateers coming up for a British trade in the first year. So Britain discovers that it has a strategic interest in getting privateering banned. And they become very interested in this new method to create international law instantly. And this solves an old problem from when positivism started to codify international, like positivist thinkers started to codify international law and say, we need to go back from these old books that are effectively philosophy and just look at what states actually do. And we need to show for something to be a norm of international law that it is based on the two conditions of state practice, states consistently do it, and opinio juris. States don't do it as a courtesy or for some other reason. They do it because they believe they are bound by law. And this new standard is very good if you have proven it for a norm, because then there's much less dispute about whether this is international law. The problem with that approach is that it takes a very long time to prove this, especially opinio juris, or that a state believes something is law. And at a time of rapid commercial globalization, especially after 1850, this became a problem. And the problem was solved in 1856 with the Declaration of Paris, because what they had invented in this package deal over neutral rights and a ban of privateering is what lawyers now call the multilateral lawmaking treaty. You know, states come together in one document and try to get the vast majority of the world's states to sign up and say, this is law and our signature is under it. And suddenly, proving opinio juris and state practice becomes child's play. Yeah? And as it happened with the Declaration of Paris, where the vast majority of states signed up in weeks and months, yeah, you could have almost instant international law. And that was a breakthrough. And that is relevant because this is precisely how we create new international law if we decide that it's necessary. Moving now on into the enforcement part, the very relevant problem is the position of the United States. Because when the Declaration of Paris reaches the newspapers of the U.S. East Coast, they feel rather taken aback and they think they've been tricked. And suddenly they are asked to sign up to the neutral rights they've always campaigned for, but also agree that their most valuable strategic weapon in case of a conflict with Britain should be thrown away. And they are vociferous. They try everything to stop this. And so the interesting question is, can they succeed? Or rather, can the majority of the states succeed in banning something that powerful countries like the United States of America really want to have? And the litmus test here came in the U.S. Civil War, where ironically it was the Confederacy that used privateering, because the North had the Navy and the Confederacy did not. And the North suddenly decided that they wanted to join the Declaration of Paris as soon as possible, and the other states decided that they would rather not want that, because they didn't want to get embroiled in the U.S. Civil War and have to chase Confederate privateers. And they accepted these privateers as legal, because neither the Confederacy nor the U.S. had ever signed the Declaration of Paris. So the really interesting thing here is why Confederate privateering goes out of business after only a year. And they are around in 1862, but not afterwards. And that is because the signatories of the Declaration of Paris accept the principle that if you've banned privateering for yourself, you also close all your ports to privateers. And that means that the Confederates can't use the Caribbean ports that belong to France, the Netherlands, Denmark, Britain, and so on, that they had counted on. And the neutral ports don't let them in. Their own ports are blockaded, and they all convert to become blockade runners. And that is the reason why privateering ends, and the Red Butler character in Gone with the Wind is a blockade runner and not a privateer.
Okay.
And the important thing here for the historian is to show that this actually works. And states enforce international law, partly by ganging up and removing the logistical basis of an activity that they want banned, or they threaten war against a state that wants to violate a norm that is important to them. And here the Civil War is another very good example, because there's not just the threat of war over the Trent Affair, which is rather well known when there's a neutral rights dispute about what is happening on a British ship that is boarded by the US Navy. There's also an actual threat of war when the United States decide that following the international rules on how to conduct a blockade of the South is actually really cumbersome, because there's 3,500 miles of coastline to patrol. And so it would be much, much nicer if these rules didn't apply. And so they come up with the idea that they can actually declare all southern ports to no longer be ports of entry for international trade under domestic U.S. customs legislation. And so any merchant coming in is then violating domestic U.S. law. And Congress passes the act. But the response by the Europeans is very clear. They just write in and say, this is just an obvious scam to get out of the requirements of international law, and we will not accept this, and we will protect the rights of our traders, in this case, to trade with the South by force if you don't have a blockade under international law. And Lincoln backed down. And another example that I'm using is the Franco-German War in 1870-71, where historians have always concentrated on the land campaign, I mean, with some legitimacy, because that actually decided the war. But there was also a global trade war and a global war at sea, where the French used their superior navy to disrupt German trade everywhere in the world. And this is a good way to show the difference between sort of states that are in the zone where international diplomacy works and states that have not yet entered it. So if you look at the activities of Prussian diplomats in Latin America, like Brazil or Argentina, or on the fringes of Europe in Greece, they succeed in limiting French freedom of action. They get the local governments to confront the French Navy and make them stick to the rules of how to conduct warfare and what they can do in neutral ports and what they cannot do. When the Prussians try to do that in China, it does not work at all, because the Chinese government of the day just not understand the concept of neutrality or international law. And they just don't understand it. And so, unlike, for example, in the Japanese ports, the French Navy has complete freedom of action in Chinese waters. The problem of successful enforcement like this is that it leaves only the tiniest of traces in the archives. I mean, successful enforcement can consist of a couple of letters in files that no one would look at normally. Whereas unsuccessful enforcement of international law tends to become, you know, well-known international history. And we all know about it. So our idea of how well international law works is consistently skewed towards failure. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the best successful enforcement is almost invisible. Mm-hmm. And the cases where enforcement fails and doesn't work, these are very visible indeed.
Right. I mean, it's clear from what you've just outlined, the value of the work that you've done. And you started to talk about it as you ended your sentence there on how it's relevant to the present day and present day international law. But in your own words, and maybe going into it with a little bit more detail, what do you think the academic or even non-academic can learn from your historical analysis with respect to the present day? How is it enlightening us?
Well, how am I enlightening the world? Well, that's a very good question. What I've tried to do in this sort of modest book is to do two things, really. The first is to give a better understanding of how international law works in practice. You know, to give an idea of how successful enforcement looks like, that there's a community behind it, and how this community enforcing international norms came about. And that is the second main point, namely that this is linked to what we now call the first wave of globalization, beginning from roughly 1850, where international trade explodes, international passenger numbers explode, emigration explodes, and the world becomes a much, much more global space in a very short period of time. And what the Declaration of Paris is, it's the blueprint on how you regulate and control something like this with the means of the 19th century. And that is, you have a conference, you agree on a certain convention, on a set of rules, and then you ask everyone else who was not at that conference to sign up. And this is done repeatedly. And shortly after 1856, you have two or three, sometimes four major international treaties passed every year. And they start to cover all sorts of things. They start to cover humanitarian rights in wartime. They start to cover the world postal system. They start to cover international communication, submarine cables, all these sorts of important things that are suddenly regulated on a global basis. And what is happening is that if you have a community of states that are agreeing 2, 3, 4 major new international treaties every year, then in the space of a generation, the role of international law changes. Suddenly, whereas before 1856, you have a couple of textbooks and a couple of agreed principles, by the end of the 19th century, you have dozens and dozens of recognized codified treaties with very detailed rules that keep the world running. And this is how effectively not just the world coped with globalization, it's also how the world made this continuing trade globalization possible, because suddenly you had comparable or similar rules in very disparate areas of the world, even in areas where you wouldn't really expect it at the time. But the reach was actually global, especially towards the very end of the 19th century, when not just Japan, but also China and the whole East Asian region come in and really form what we would now call the international community. Now, if you have something like that, and we still do, then suddenly it's not just an international norm that needs to be protected, it's the entire network, it's the entire system of how things are done that needs to be protected. If you can get more and more states on board instead of fighting them, by giving them a voice in how the norms are created to ensure you have global reach, that's a very sensible thing to do for a great power, and that's precisely what happened. And that's why when we come to the world of the Hague Peace Conferences, you have almost every state in the world represented. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And suddenly states like Persia have equal voting rights on sort of these norm-making sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that is something that hasn't been recognized that much in the wider field, especially sort of if you go out of sort of specialist global history or legal history. And the other thing that I'm talking about at the very end of the book is if we have a system that is based on community enforcement and sort of states ganging up together and going to the one state that defies the rules and say, well, if you do that, you have to confront all of us. What happens if the international community breaks down? And that is my approach to explaining why we have such a detailed system of international law that then falls down so spectacularly at the beginning of the First World War and once more at the beginning of the Second World War. If states collectively decide that they no longer live in an international community, but that the system has broken down, then the whole system falls back on just reciprocity alone. And the lesson is that does not work very well. And if the sense of international community goes, so does international law. And we enter this Hobbesian world,
mm-hmm.
that I've mentioned before. So the interesting question for today, I mean, especially if you look at contemporary crises like in, say, Ukraine, is how can international law or international diplomacy contribute or help to make sure that the norms are enforced without the sense of international community going? Because the lesson of the past here clearly is that if that happens, that's not a good thing for anyone concerned. And the other thing that I wanted to bring out is that something that is not really mentioned, especially by sort of cynics of international law who say, well, the world wars are where we really see that it's all about power and this is how you make real history. And they tend to ignore that the winners of global conflicts, the leaders who emerged victorious from this Hobbesian world, what they always want to do immediately is have a big conference and create a world that is regulated much more tightly and much more comprehensively than anything before the big conflict. So that happens in 1815 at the Congress of Vienna, when all European states, including France, are invited to create an order that makes sure that the chaos of the Napoleonic Wars never returns. After the First World War, you end up with the League of Nations and a totally different scale of ambition for global community and regulation. And after the Second World War, what happens is that states of the world sit down in San Francisco and try to create something they call United Nations, which they insist has to have much, much more power and authority than the League of Nations ever had. And I think these two processes of the experience of the Hobbesian world and the desire to create a better regulated one are very much linked.
And I think that this unique approach that you've got in the book with reference to power and law is definitely something that I want to highlight again, because it's certainly not something, as you've already said, that books actually deal with, whether it's a historian, whether it's a lawyer. I think they tend to separate the two quite distinctly. And one thing that I did find extremely novel was this sort of intertwinement of power and law that you quite clearly highlight. And of course, is quite relevant for today as well when we make those connections, both in terms of continuities and discontinuities, of course. So I want to say that I've thoroughly enjoyed listening from the horse's mouth about a book which I actually thoroughly enjoyed reading. And I think that any listener that decides to pick up the book will thoroughly enjoy reading it too. So I highly recommend it. So I want to thank you. Very grateful to have you here at the network. And I hope you enjoyed talking about your book with us too.
Yes, I enjoyed it very much, and I can assure readers that I've spent much sweat and many, many hours in trying to explain the complex detail of international law that I had to include as easily and persuasively and accessible as possible, because as obscure as this sometimes may be, none of this is unfathomable, and I've tried to explain it in a couple of easy sentences so that absolutely everyone can follow. You don't need a law degree to read this book. What I've tried to do is really get the idea out of the way that international law is something sterile and only for lawyers, and that it is somehow separate from politics and international affairs. And it is not, and it has never been. It has never been a depoliticized thing. And so if we look at the world today and find that well, there seems to be a lot of affairs where rules of international law and power politics seem to be tangled up. My message is, it was ever thus, and we need to deal with it.
Well, with those words, thank you very much.
Thank you, Shivana.